Use it. Anyway, verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write the words of the first and the last. I'm reading out of the ESV, so if you're having, it seems a little different. These are the words of him who is first and last, who died and came to life. I know your tribulation, or your version may say affliction. I know your affliction and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. Now, let me set this up. Have you ever had, you know that moment when someone tries to give you some kind of smarmy advice for where you're at? That's some kind of, they're like a walking greeting card, and they come and they tell you some kind of really easy solution to the predicament that you're in. So you're in a moment where you are really under the fire of life, whatever that is. You're really confused. You're really alone. Financially, you're up against the wall. Employment-wise, you can't find anything. Some relational break has happened, or you even hope for a relationship so that maybe a break could happen later. Like, you're just in some kind of longing or hopelessness or whatever that is. And someone comes along and they try to tell you some kind of just trite, pithy line that really just makes you roll your eyes. Do you know, have you been in this spot where you're just like, I wish, now you just made me more mad that you're even saying anything, right? I just rather you shut up than offer me any kind of, oh, it'll be all right. Oh, you'll get over it. Oh, you know, everyone goes through this. It'll be no problem at all. Like that, like those kind of bumper sticker kinds of lines. The reason we don't like it is because, what we really want is someone who really listens. And what we really want is someone who's really invested in us. If you're going to talk to me when I'm in this mode, I need certain things to be true. And if those things aren't true, then I need you to get out of my face. It's been in this last May was 11 years, but when I was 22, my girlfriend at that time, we'd been dating for about 6 months, and she passed away in a tragic car accident. And I had just left Taylor after my senior year, and she was a couple years younger and was going to work at a camp for the summer. And Melissa was her name. She's trying to pass a vehicle, and she hits a logging truck. She made a bad decision. And she hit a logging truck, and then I'll never forget, of course, I mean, in that kind of tragic situation, I get the frantic, screaming phone call from her mother, she's dead, she's dead, she's dead, she's dead. And it was just, it's, you know, your life has these, like, very few moments that radically define you, or they radically affect you, or they radically, you know, it's just the moment where you hit the wall and everything around you becomes this giant disorientation. I can't tell you the number of people that I just wanted to vomit upon in that whole season of my life. People who tried to come alongside me and say, oh, it'll totally be okay. I mean, God's will, God has someone else for you. Like, the last thing I need to hear whenever I'm like wrestling with she doesn't even exist anymore in physical form is for you to tell me that there's someone else out there, you know? It's in those moments that it takes all of your resolve just to, like, not say something really tragic back to that person. Do you know what I'm talking about? This is really huge. We all live in crises at various moments, and we're all interacting with each other as we go through these crises, and sometimes we say the stupidest things to one another because we don't know what else to say. And in the moment, what you really want is someone authentically looking at you in the eye who really has listened to you and who really has invested in you. And those people have permission to say certain things in your life. But right after my girlfriend dies in a car accident and we've been dating for 6 months, I don't need you to come alongside me and say, God has a perfect will and everything's going to be okay. Whether or not that is true, I don't need you to say that to me. Why? Because the source of the perspective given means as much as the perspective given. The person who's telling you to have perspective in a certain moment, the source of that perspective means everything in terms of even what their perspective is. It doesn't matter what they're saying. It matters how they're saying it and who it is that's saying it. So when I sat down for coffee across from someone after a tragedy like that, someone could sit down across from me and say, it's okay. That in the wreckage, God works everything out for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. That's Romans 8:28. Now, someone could sit down across from me and say, Matt, Romans 8:28 says, and they could quote it. Now, someone else could sit down and they could say Romans 8:28 and quote it. The first one, I want to shoot him in the face with a super soaker, right? The other one can bring me to tears because I know they're telling me the truth. Right? Someone sits down from you and wants to quote you a Bible verse, and they're just like throwing you something because they have no relevance to your setting. There's no authenticity, there's no relationship. So the moment they say, well, but Matt, God can turn everything into good and this can happen, you just want to say, you have no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea what you're talking about, and you're making me sick by trying to put some kind of bumper sticker or greeting card over my tragedy right now. Don't do that to me. And it makes you even more incited with anger. Do you know that emotion that I'm talking about? The flip side of that is someone can quote that same thing. They could say the same words verbatim. But if they're speaking from a source of perspective that has relevance behind it, when that happens in that moment, you're like so zeroed in that you're just going, like, yes, you're speaking life to me. You quoted the same verse and... okay, God is going to work it out for the good. The reason that that disparity exists is all about the source of the perspective. Now, this whole Smyrna church, that what we've been, we talked about Ephesus last week, and we're going to dive into Pergamum next week. And in the weeks ahead, we're going to be diving into this whole series of the churches where it says, these are the words, and then it gives a vision of who Jesus is. It gives some words for these churches that are both historical and I think symbolic of the whole church. And then it gives some kind of warning and some kind of reward at the end. And the whole idea of this church in Smyrna is perspective. Every church has something wrong with it but two. There's nothing wrong with the church in Smyrna. Normally it says, you have forsaken your first love. You are lukewarm and God wants to spew you out of his mouth. Like some of these familiar passages, sometimes God needs to chastise the church. Because the church is messy and chaotic. And I mean, any group of people becomes really messy really quickly. And so sometimes there's these warnings. But with Smyrna, it just says, I know that you're afflicted. I know that you're going through the tribulation. I know that you're poor. So some of your versions, the NIV says that I know your affliction and your poverty. But I have a different perspective for you. It says, you are rich. Now, of course, you would never think that. I mean, that any of us in this room who live in poverty, if you've ever lived in poverty in your past, if you see poverty coming in your future, I mean, when you're there, there is no, like, no one can tell you you're rich. And if they do, you probably get upset with them because they're coming at you with some kind of, who are you to say to me that I am rich? Except this whole bit starts with an ounce of perspective. It says from Jesus, and it says this, from the first, and it defines Jesus as the first and the last. And the person who went through death and came back to life again. In other words, the perspective from which Jesus is speaking says, I was here before it all, I will be here after it all, and I went all the way through the fire, through death, and I now came out victorious over it. There is nothing I haven't been through. And there's nothing that I don't have perspective on. So rather than someone having no authority to speak to me in terms of perspective, Jesus says, I have every bit of authority to tell you how things really are. If there's ever a source that we should believe for the perspective in our lives, it's the perspective of Jesus. There's no greater perspective giver of all than hearing what does Jesus have to say about this. What does Jesus have to say about my life? What does Jesus have to say about this topic? What does Jesus have to say about this? That's not a religious thing. That's a grandest perspective thing. So the writer here is trying to get us to see these ideas that Jesus' perspective over everything is essential to understanding Smyrna. So you have this group of people, and they're really suffering. Now, there's a historical church in Smyrna. The Roman Empire is huge at this point, which I think everyone knows, and it extended well into Asia. And so Ephesus and Pergamum and Smyrna would fight over the title, quote, first city of Asia. And it was kind of like, so you have these three really prominent cities. And so there's this progression going from the church to the church. There's these prominent kind of new Christian communities in these historical cities. And they all have these really different characteristics. And so Ephesus, you're this, and I tell you this, but now this is true. That was last week. And so then this week it says, you guys who are in Smyrna, you're going through the persecution. You're going through the fire. You're living in poverty. You've all been afflicted, but this is what I want to tell you. I want to tell you that you are rich. Now, that's not some kind of feel-good statement. What Jesus is saying is, you're looking around at your earthly stuff, and you don't see much at all. But I'm telling you, I see the things that really matter, and you are rich. And it's part of what Big Red talked about a little bit, where he was saying, you know, the things, when we store up our own things on earth, it's when we get attached to certain things, and we have to be people who are free to let the Spirit move in our life to bring the things that really matter. Let me put it this way. Normally, we have a list of the things that we need to acquire. We do this when we go to the grocery store. If you are a responsible grocery store goer, you go. You know, there's all this advice. Don't go when you're hungry. Make a list. Don't go when you're hungry. I don't even know, really. So I know those two from watching enough Oprah to hear something over time. But you know what I'm saying. So you're supposed to have a list. And when you go to the store, you have a list. And I need green beans, and I need corn, and I need sugar, and I need frosted flakes, and I need whatever else that is on your list. That's your list. I have a list of things that I need. And when I get those, then I will be okay. And so I have this list of things, and if I acquire them, then things will finally be right. I will feel okay with my life when I have this set. So when I have someone, or when I have this job, or when I get that promotion, or when I'm living in this house, or when I hit this age, or when I get this degree, or when I'm at this point in my life, or when I have two kids, or when I acquire the picket fence, and when I get my kids through school, or when I get, like, whatever, we have this list. Everything will be okay when I acquire or achieve these things. And usually with stuff, we have a list of life would be grander if these things were true. Now, I don't know that this is necessarily biblical, but I think this is okay. I think there's an opposite list in heaven, wherever heaven is, right? I think God has a list. If I let you have this, you won't develop that. If I give you this, you want to acquire all these things, but I think there's like the anti-list, where God is saying, I am most interested in developing in you the ability to be really alive. Because when you are the most alive, you bring the most glory to God. So I want you to be full of life. I want you to be full of hope. I want you to have character and the fruit of the Spirit. I want you to be well-shaped, created as you were intended to be. I want you to have shalom in your life. So if you have this, you will never have to develop patience. If I give you this, you will never have to develop that character. If you pray to have this, and you don't have it, so you cry out to the heavens. And God's going, that's on my list of things I can't give you, or else you won't be shaped properly. And so we look at our circumstances and we think, look at me, I'm so poor, I'm so afflicted, I don't have these things. And I think God is saying, actually, you're rich because you don't have those things. You look at the things you don't have, and then you cry foul versus saying, maybe I'm answering prayers all along by like allowing you to be rich in places that you don't even know. And you're not even thankful for them. You want to be rich in areas that you're not ready for. You want to have things that will ruin you. You're asking me for things that will own you in the end. And that's not what I'm interested in. So if you're praying for me for certain things and you don't have them, you're crying about your afflicted nature or you're crying about being poor. But the perspective of Jesus tells us that things are different, that the kingdom is upside down. And so in fact, that we're rich. In the next section, it even says I know the slander against you. I mean, this happens at times, and certainly in the early church, where all these people were martyrs, and Polycarp, historically, is the first bishop of Smyrna, and Polycarp was a disciple of John. So what you have is John, who's writing this letter, is writing to Smyrna, and there's probably a bit of some personal nature going on. And so Polycarp was martyred in like 150 or something like that, and he's got this sort of great church history story, if you will. And so he's writing to Polycarp, and he's saying, like, I need you to hold on. The perspective of God tells you, yeah, you're all dying for your faith. You all have nothing. You all are like losing for the cause, but I'm telling you, you're rich. And I know that some of the Jews are coming against you and they're slandering you. And there's kind of different takes on exactly what that means, because some of the Jews had even joined the movement. But there's this idea, sometimes you're just like, ah, God, I wish that you would expose this person for who they really are. Does anyone not know? Can you not see how much of a snake he is? You're like falling in love with him. And I'm telling you, like, don't you see? I mean, you've like watched someone descend into the bad relationship. And you're thinking like, I'm trying to put up like every NASCAR flag I possibly could to keep you from like going that direction. And you're going that direction anyway, because our heart like takes us to crazy places at times, because we're full of so much longing to be loved and to be known and to belong. And so sometimes our heart carries us to crazy places, and the people around us are like, no, 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 no. Like, I can see clearly, and you are heading places, and what are you doing? And you watch them like go right over the cliff anyway. And you're standing there like, I'm trying to tell you, there are these moments in this slanderous way. There are these moments where you're like, God, don't you know, how does he still have a position of power and influence? You even do this sometimes as Christians. You turn on the television and you see someone doing something in the name of God, and it seems really perverse. And you're like, God, how do you allow that? How are you not filled with lightning and just like, psh, like go science museum on the guy? Like, how does that not happen? How are you allowing certain things to happen? The early church is filled with these moments. There's all kinds of false prophets coming in. It's not like there's a website where you can look up whether someone is legitimate or not. There's not a Better Business Bureau for prophets where you look up and say, are they okay or not? I mean, there's just kind of everywhere all the time there are people who say, I'm speaking in the name of God. And since that didn't exist in the moment, you're left going, ah, do we trust him? Do we not? These people come in and they slander us, and they're getting people to move out of our movement, and we don't know what to do. And so God, please. And so Jesus says, I know the things you are up against. I know how they really are. I know the character of those people. You don't have to wonder if I'm in heaven not getting it. I think this is really huge, because we often paint a picture of a God where we wonder, do you even get it? Do you even see anything? Or am I down here some kind of cosmic pawn that you forgot that I'm on this side of the chessboard, and you played for a while over here, and now you've moved on to some other territory in some kind of game? Oftentimes, when I've gone through the fire, when the car crash happened, when I got fired from that job that I've talked about before, I mean, you know, whenever I've like, when my car got repossessed, when any country song is played itself out in my life, right? That there's these moments, or when you've lived alongside people who have lost something, the common response is, does God even know? Now, this message to the church in Smyrna is, yes. A capital Y, capital E, capital S, exclamation, period. That there is this, Yes, I know the slander is happening. Yes, I know who they really are. Yes, I know your poverty and your affliction. And it's not the way that it looks. The last one that says, now look, Smyrna, you're going to have to go through a period of 10 days of suffering. Now, some people, the real literal interpretation of that is there's 10 days of something. That group of people had something coming, that it was a prophetic word, and that there was 10 days of some kind of zaniness that was going to happen to the church. And maybe that is completely true. Some other people view it as a period of like 10 years of suffering, that it was a prophetic statement that under a certain Roman emperor in a certain season, the persecution of the church lasted for these 10 particular years. Another way, and a lot of scholars also refer, so all of these may be true, and some of these may not be, and however you want to picture things. But most scholars tend to agree on that numbers are pretty relevant in the book of Revelation. So 7 is the complete picture. 7 is the number of God. I mean, we've heard a lot of these kind of things before. So there's 7 days in a week that brings a completeness to it. But another number that is intended to mean something that is complete is 10. In other words, I have 10 fingers and 10 toes. And that there's kind of a completeness or a totality in that number. And so a lot of the scholars of the book of Revelation say that this idea that God says, I'm going to test you for 10 days, means that I'm going to take you through a period of complete testing. Now, if you are faithful, it says, if you are faithful all the way through it, you will receive the crown of life. Now, the crown of life, you guys remember that song that has the word diadem in it? Bring forth the royal diadem and crown him Lord of all, right? That there's this, now diadem, that's the only time I've ever heard that word used, and it's in a popular hymn. And diadem is like a royal crown, but the word here is Stephanos, which means the wreath given like in the ancient Olympic games. There would be this really complex wreath. Now the wreath is given in a few instances to a few persons who finish really well. If you're an athlete and you finish the race, you're given this crown. You have finished wonderfully. You started, you didn't just sprint, you paced yourself, and at the very end, you came out the victor, Stephanos, for you. It's also a Roman magistrate. If you're a government official and you had a really good term of order and leadership, and you finish that term really well, Stephanos, for you. Here's your crown. There's this idea of saying, like, here is the crown. The persons in our culture who don't just start well but finish well, John takes that in this vision and this analogy and says, if you can make it through the 10 days of testing, Jesus has something for you on the other side, and that's the crown that says, yes, you did it. Yes, you made it. Yes, you made it through the fire. Now, in the middle of it, we lose perspective. In the middle of it, we don't know what's going on. In the middle of it, we're crying foul. Oh my gosh, I'm poor and I'm afflicted. And look at my poverty and look at the people who slander me and look at the affliction I'm within. And look, I mean, some of us are losing our lives for this cause. God, where are you? And we long, Jesus, would you say something, anything to me at all? Jesus, do you have any perspective where I'm at all? And the letter to the church in Smyrna says, yeah, actually, I'm the one orchestrating this suffering. I'm with you in the suffering. Now, here's what I love. My favorite part of this whole thing is this. Jesus's perspective is so rich that... how do I say this? Jesus tells suffering how long it can last. I think this is going to be the best thing I have to tell you this morning. That there's if you read this, all of a sudden you begin to see, wow, Jesus is telling suffering how long it has the capability of lasting. When we're in the suffering, we're crying out, how long, O Lord? David says that. Joel says that. Isaiah says that. It's a common thread, and Job says that. All the way through the scriptures, it seems like a common prayer is, "How long, O Lord?" And what Smyrna reminds us is that God is able to say exactly how long, because God stands not only with us in the suffering, but Jesus stands outside of the suffering and says, "I have the ability and power to tell suffering how long it has. And then when it's over, I'm the one who's still standing, because I am the first and the last, and I went through it, and I have the ability to tell suffering when it can begin and when it can end." And so for us to be able to have this perspective from Jesus, to be able to hear from Jesus, is the ability to go, "You know what, I'm in the fire right now. I wish I didn't have to do, it's that Garden of Gethsemane moment when Jesus is praying, "Not my will, but yours be done." But then Jesus also prays, "But I pray that you wouldn't make me do this. I don't want to be here." That's a very authentic prayer. Yet in the end, Jesus also knew that God stood outside of that and said, "You stand on the other side of the cross. You stand on the other side of this timeline." Right now, it feels like there's no end, except I know that there is, and my God can name the end of that. So there's an ability for me to stand in the middle of everything that's going on. I went out last night with a couple of really good long-term friends. And they've both been through the ringer, but one of these guys has just, I've been watching the devastation of his life really close and been spending a lot of time with him. The funny thing, it's not funny. Why do we say a funny thing is when it's not funny at all? But anyway, the thing is about this moment is that 8 years ago or so-ish, and I've talked about this before as a part of my story, but I went through a season where I was suicidal, I was going to say I didn't want to live, but that's the definition of suicidal, right? There was a moment where I had nothing to live for, and when you really believe that that's fully true, then you just don't want to live. That's the natural outcome of that. So I'd been depressed. I was at the end of myself. One of my friends comes to me in that moment. That's this guy. And he looks at me. He actually drugged me to Muncie Alliance Church on a Sunday morning. And he tried to come visit me, and I didn't want to talk to him, and I'd hang up the phone and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to be isolated, and he broke through my isolation, and he had the authenticity. He'd lived with me. He had this perspective where I would listen to him when other people were telling me to get over it. Jay came to me and he said, "You are coming with me this morning. I am not leaving until you're coming with me to church. So get some clothes on. Could care less if you shower. But you're going to get out of bed today. And I know you didn't get out of bed the last 2 days, except probably to use the restroom. So you're going to come with me today, and we're going to go to church. And we can sit on the back row if you want, but we have a destination. And today is the day." And so I knew he meant business, so he wasn't leaving. So I get up. And the whole way that we're going there, he's trying to tell me what's true. And I'm mentally writing him off. "Screw you. Get out of my face. I don't want this. Don't give me a pep talk." Whatever the typical thoughts are. And we go to church, and my life forever changed in that moment. So recently, Jay's been going through his own ringer. And his whole life is crumbling, and everything he has been building for has been taken away. It's been a really, really, it's been heart-wrenching to be alongside this guy. But he's starting to get a little bit of perspective. So I spent all last night with this guy, and we were sitting down with another friend, and we were laughing about this, just this exchange. And he's like, "Man, it's really ironic. We've like switched seats." And I'm like, "Yeah, man, this is really rich. Like, we did perspective swapping last night. Do you remember when? Do you remember when I couldn't see anything for my own self and you told me how things really were? Yeah, you saved my life that day," right? And then like 8 years later, we're like talking, and he said, "Yeah, when you drove down and just sat with me on my front porch and you just let me like smoke 3 packs of cigarettes in 1 hour, and like you just didn't say anything at all. Like you just let me like vent and say and cry. Like you cried with me, and you just like when you told me that everything was going to be okay, I knew I believed you because I knew we'd been there in that moment. Like there's something so powerful about the person who looks at us and says, yeah, I know your affliction and I know your poverty and I know the slander and I know you're in the middle of it, but I'm telling you it only lasts 10 days. I have perspective outside of this that tells you there is an ending to the scenario in which you are in. Yeah, I know it looks like this is going on, but you're actually really rich. I mean, and so Jay's been full of these people who are all surrounding him, telling him all of these really crappy statements to make to someone who is going through the ringer. And he says, I've had to like check out of Facebook because people are sending me, you know, virtual flowers or, you know, like, hey, Jay, don't forget, everything is great. And in the end, and blah, 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 like that kind of stuff. And he's like, but you guys can say the same things and it makes all the difference. Why? Because the source of who's saying it matters more than anything. It's not just about what's being said. It's about the fact that the person saying it maybe actually knows what they're talking about. The purpose of the church, this letter to the church in Smyrna starts with the first statement. The one saying these things to you in the testing is the one who is the first and the last and who went through death and came out the other side. There's no greater perspective than the one offered by Jesus who says, I can name the time of suffering. Suffering doesn't have the last word. I have the last word. In fact, Jesus is outside of linear time, and I think it's theologically correct to say that Jesus has watched already the end of all suffering. And we who live in linear time have yet to experience that. But the book of Revelation ends with, you guys, this is how it goes down. This is how it ends. And so we either trust in that or we give ourselves over to the temporary perspective and mess our whole life up.